For more presentations like this, visit www.xenos.org.
All right, so we are going to study 2 Corinthians chapters 8 and 9 over the next 3 weeks, maybe 4. I don't know, haven't quite figured that out yet. But want to roll up our sleeves and begin to interact with together some areas that I think are just so incredibly important to us in our own spiritual life and in terms of our capacity to extend ourselves in a compelling way to the world around us. So it seems like there's a whole lot at stake in these issues, and I want to just dive right in. We're in 2 Corinthians chapter 8, verses 1 to 5 this evening, and we're going to talk about the challenge of wealth. And here's what we're talking about here. Starting in verse 1, he says, "I want you to know, dear brothers and sisters, what God in his kindness has done through the churches of Macedonia. They are being tested by many troubles, and they're very poor. But they are also filled by abundant joy, which is overflowed into rich generosity. I can testify that they gave not only what they could afford, but far more. And they did it of their own free will. They begged us again and again for the privilege of sharing in the gift for the believers in Jerusalem. They did more than we had hoped, for their first action was to give themselves to the Lord, then to us, just as God wanted them to." Okay, I want to paint a little historical background because this is an important part of the discussion here. Paul makes mention of this gift for the believers in Jerusalem. And what happened was, and one of the real major drives in Paul's second missionary journey, three times Paul travels all over the Roman Empire, establishing churches and stuff like this. The second one was motivated very substantially by a famine that had broken out in Jerusalem. That's, of course, you know, where did the church start? It started in Jerusalem. And there was still a very significant body of Christians still living there. And, you know, as things would have it, you have one bad harvest in the ancient world with the ancient kind of agricultural techniques that they had and stuff like that. And all of a sudden, boom, you're looking at real shortages and people's lives are at risk. And that was the case in Jerusalem. There was a famine. And so Paul really viewed it as crucial that the Gentile churches, the non-Jewish churches that were scattered all over the empire, would stand in there, raise money, so that they could buy whatever grain was available to alleviate the famine that was happening down there in Jerusalem. And this, turns out, is a real watershed issue in early Christianity. It's one of the real defining moments of the church. Because at this stage of the game, you've got the Christian community kind of split and coming apart at the seams along ethnic lines in terms of Jews and Gentiles. And there's a little bit of friction and animosity, actually, between Jewish Christians and Gentile Christians over things that we don't need to get into here tonight. And also between rich Christians and poor Christians, and that certainly was something that was happening in the Corinthian church as well. And so to be able to get some clarity on this issue and to actually extend ourselves and to meet the real pressing material needs of other Christians who are different than us, who we do not know by name, who we've never met before, but who have the same relationship with God through Christ that we do. You know, to be able to have that kind of unity where we're just prepared to sacrifice for them like we would for a person that we do know or a family member or something like that. That's what's going on. And that kind of sacrifice is one of the things that really held together this early Christian movement and really defined their character. You know, are we prepared when we see people who are hurting circumstantially, materially, to just drop what we're into, voluntarily limit our way of living, and come alongside and meet those real needs of other people? It builds character. And a lot of, you know, what is often said, and I think it's true, is that the last thing that's converted is the pocketbook. That's all right. We struggle in this area. But at the end of the day, it's really where Christians invest their wealth, that says a lot about who they recognize as their Lord. And there's a witness to the world about what God is about and what we are about as God's people that really gets more or less identified through the way that we spend our money. And so there's a big deal in the ancient world. There's a big deal for us today as well. As more Christians today live in conditions of famine than perhaps at any other time in the history of the church. Let me say that again so that you understand what I'm saying. That more Christians globally live in conditions of famine today than they have ever since the beginning of the church. I think that that's a pretty easy to define statistic. Okay, it is the way it is. And how we then, as the affluent West, the American church, interact with those problems become really the defining moment for us as a church, the opportunity that we have before us. And what I want to talk about over the next 3 weeks is really a parallel discussion. What Paul is talking about to the Corinthians in 2 Corinthians chapters 8 and 9, really there are principles and circumstances that are absolutely relevant to us in our present day. I want to bring those two worlds together as much as we can and talk about that from three different vantage points. Namely, first, the challenge of wealth. And Paul, in this passage, in this paragraph, and in others that will follow, really gets into the discussion of how should we, what is the relationship of our wealth to our spiritual lives? Is there a bearing of how do I advance spiritually? How is my experienced connection with God facilitated or hampered by the way that I use my money? And the Bible, of course, is not silent on this issue, that there is a price for pursuing wealth, that there is a value that we place on wealth, and that can often be super important and really facilitate God's work in our lives and his work through us to the rest of the world, or it can be a great impediment to what God is trying to accomplish in our lives. So it's not a neutral thing. Money is not spiritually neutral. Let me just make that really clear. You know, a lot of times through the history of the church, people have been manipulated about money and, you know, guilt manipulated into giving or feeling like, you know, if you don't give or whatever, then God will think less of you, God won't accept you or whatever. The Bible, of course, never says that, and we are certainly not saying that here. What we're talking about is a conversation among people who say, yes, I have come to know God personally through Jesus Christ. I am a Christian in the biblical sense of that. And what does my wealth have to do with my spiritual vitality? That's the question that we want to get at to a substantial degree here tonight. Next week, we're going to come back because, you know, the social values that are out there about money, about career, things like that, are spiritually corrosive. And they don't promote generosity. We're not that generous of a culture. And again, we'll talk about that. So in some ways, what we're calling on, the Bible is calling on us to do, in much the same way as the affluent Corinthians, is to more or less resist the tide of social values that more or less tell us, you know, its story about how we should handle our wealth. And we're going to talk in some practical detail about that tonight. How to engage cultural attitudes about wealth and get a biblical view on that. Next week, we want to talk about financial freedom. And, you know, everyone's about being financially free, right? Secure. No, we're not going to talk about a new pyramid scheme or something like that. What we're going to talk about is the biblical view of stewardship. That, you know, whose wealth is the wealth that you call yours at the end of the day anyway? Well, God says, as a matter of fact, it's his, that he's given us a stewardship. He's given us access to those resources, but they belong to him. What does that mean, and how does that work? And how does that relate, then, to a lifestyle of real generosity? Well, Paul's going to go and kind of lay that out later on in chapter 8, and the bottom line is going to be that it's easy to be generous with somebody else's money, isn't it? And so if your money is really God's, shouldn't be that hard to invest his money. It's not yours anyway. Wow, we'll talk about how to make that a little bit more intuitive. The third week on this study, we're going to talk about affluence and poverty, both in the ancient world and in our own day. And there, Paul talks a lot in this chapter, chapter 9 specifically, about justice. And that, you know, and Jesus also viewed how we allocate our resources in the light of the pressing needs of people around us, across the street, across the city, across the world, are matters that God takes very seriously. And these are matters of justice, and they do matter to God, and they need to matter to us. And we're going to talk about what does it mean to engage globally from where we are right here. We're a church that's about that. We're interested in that. So happy that we've got some of our Cambodia team here tonight. Maybe you can talk to us about that. But that's a significant issue. And we have got to win an important battle along those lines. So that's where we're going in this discussion. I think it's super valuable. And I want to just kick it off by reorienting our thinking a little bit here in terms of what is the challenge of wealth that we feel in our day. Now, vertigo. You know what vertigo is? The first time I ever really experienced this was the first time I ever went swimming in the ocean out in the Pacific. I had never, you know, been around waves or whatever. In fact, I'd never been outside of 270 until I was like an adult. But anyway, all that's changed. But anyway, my first experience of the Pacific Ocean was like I just ran out there and was like, oh, I can't believe I'm in the ocean. And then this wave just, boom, comes crashing down on me. And for a moment, I'm like, I don't know what way is up, what way is down. Where am I? That's vertigo. And so swimmers experience that. You know, pilots can experience that. It's really a bad news kind of thing when they do. But that's what vertigo is. It's just complete loss of a frame of reference for what direction I'm heading. All right? Now, here's the thing that I want to impress upon you is the thought that with respect to wealth, most people in our culture are in a state of vertigo. That we're really profoundly confused on this issue and we don't know what direction we're even heading in. I want to put it in these terms. Robert Reich was the labor secretary for 6 years under the Clinton administration, and he quit 2 years before he had to. For personal reasons, and he has written a book recently called The Future of Success. And in The Future of Success, he begins to talk about some of the vertigo that is so characteristic of our culture with respect to its wealth. He makes the point, for instance, that per family, we work 8 weeks more per year over the last 10 years than we did, you know, 10 years ago. 8 weeks of work more per household over the last 10 years, surpassing, he says, even the Japanese. You know, most of us think of the Japanese as, you know, they're all about the corporation and work, 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 work. And they're kind of that way. But did you know that in our own American households, we put in more time working than even the Japanese do? That's remarkable. He makes the point, he says, that the average American house size is more than double the size of the largest European countries. Housing. Italians have the best sized houses in Europe. Their house size is just under half the size of American houses. And the houses that are being built today are twice the size of the houses that were being built a generation ago. Now, what does that mean? What are the implications? Do you think that there might be a relationship between the incredible and mounting number of hours a week that we work and the size of our McMansions? I can say, of course it's that way. These things are not just given away. A third thing that's pointed out is while we have soaring incomes, we also have soaring debts. That the amount of indebtedness per household in America is completely off the charts. We are making more money than we have ever made before as a household. And we have never been in this tragic sort of debt situation. And the circumstance that then we look at as a culture with respect to our wealth is like this. It's like we're in a system that makes earning and the consuming the central preoccupation of life. That's really what it's about. And leaves us, paradoxically, as the most affluent culture in the world, feeling poor and exhausted. Of course I don't have any money to give to alleviate the pressing needs of other people around me. I'm barely squeaking by at my $100,000 a year salary. I just don't know how I'm going to do it. I mean, how can I be expected to live under these oppressive conditions? And you say to yourself, well, that just sounds stupid. It's not like that. Well, yeah, it is. Yeah, it really is like that, actually. And what we need to think about here this evening a little bit is we need to think about what does it look like to be productive. We're not saying here we shouldn't be productive. We're not saying here we shouldn't work hard and take our career seriously. Don't walk out of here with the idea that I'm calling on us to be slackers. Okay, I'm not saying that. And the Bible does not teach that. But what we want to get at is how can we meet the legitimate needs that our families have in this culture to work responsibly and heartily as unto God in the workplace, and at the same time not be sucked in by the latent dangers that really are there, where we're feeling like it is the norm to work 60, 70, and 80 hours a week. Where it's the norm to dig ourselves into debt to the extent that basically what we can pay, what we can handle each month is interest payments and this type of thing. And what happens is that the nation that has the greatest resources available to it is actually that nation which is most in bondage to material acquisition. And so we want to talk about, what does it look like to really be honest and face the realities of the marketplace and try to get some biblical clarity on our lives and on our careers. I want to suggest to you that this is the biggest deal we will ever face as a church. Because our ability to have financial sanity and sanity with respect to our work lives is either going to give us freedom and facilitate a vibrant family life and a life of real generosity with our time and ministry and our financial resources that really speak volumes about the God we say we worship, or we'll end up just looking like the rest of the culture. And our faith will be nothing more than just a sanctification of the cultural status quo. And we will lose our voice in this culture. I would suggest, in fact, that it's already too late. That the evangelical church in a broad sweep in this culture has lost its voice, and largely for this reason. And we need to be different. And we need to think about this together. And you say to yourself, well, who are you to tell us, how to do this kind of stuff and all that? And I say, I'm nobody. But I do know some bodies. And what we're going to do here this evening is a little bit different. Instead of listening to me blathering on, we're going to bring some couples together that I know pretty well and have known for years now at this point, who have thought through the whole career materialism kind of draw. They've arrived at some conclusions about that, and they've made really important decisions in their lives that I think make them stand out as more or less beacons of light to us as we sort of think these things through. So I'd like to introduce to you some friends, Sean and Cindy Fitzpatrick. Come on up and grab a seat. Okay, Gary and Shelley Ware, come on up. And Malia and Steve Bauer. Okay, what we're going to do is we're going to think together in tangible and practical terms. Not theoretical, but life situational terms about what does it mean to have biblical sanity about career and money at a place where we could be doing a lot more than what we are. All right, welcome to the machine. And welcome, panelists. We're going to have them up. They're going to do a spiel. We're going to whisk them off. I'm going to finish up, and then we're going to have some discussion here tonight. We'll start with Bow Bows. Now, little known fact about the Bowers is that they're both kind of these type A crazy personalities, Arthur Anderson consulting type of zeal there. Malia worked for some years in New York City as a retail acquirer of things. Was very serious about that. Here's a couple. They understand what career success is really all about, and they've really thought through this in a big way. And I want to ask them, starting with Steve, how did the carrot and stick motivation of the corporate world appeal to your sense of identity and value? Because what we want to suggest here is that there is something that is drawing people into surrendering 60 and 80 hours of their week voluntarily. What was that, Steve?
Yeah, as we thought about this, we had a couple days to think about, you know, over the last 25 years, where, you know, decisions I've made and stuff in career, and thinking about, like, we all have objectives as performers. Think about identity and value, and the identity as a, from a performance standpoint, expectations. I grew up in Upper Arlington, okay, and like there was a natural expectation in this, you know, affluent suburban area. Yeah, I mean, not incredibly driven from one standpoint, but surrounded by success, family success, and you start to get into a mode of certain assumptions about what success looks like. So, you know, even at 18, of course I'm going to go to school. Of course I'm going to be successful. I'm going to go into business. I mean, I knew that when I was like 17. And go out and what's, you know, answer the question of identity even at that age. Well, you know, I'm this kid. I work. I'm going to school. I know where I'm going. I'm going to make six figures. I'm going to have a house. Those are things that are going to define milestones in my life and drive to those, you know, and boy, I'm surrounded by people who are just like that. And you can find then people who, those carrots that are dangling out there. I work for Accenture, Anderson Consulting, and the drive to be a partner, real easy to get sucked into, and then go out of town, get sent out of town and spend easy 70 hours. Just what you do. You have a lot of people who are pursuing the exact same thing. And I had the, you know, I guess whatever, the pleasure of becoming a Christian while I was doing that work and seeing God change my mind about what my identity was. But, you know, shoot, that was 19 years ago. And yet I still struggle with some of the same things. Identity runs deep. My performance-driven anxiety runs really deep. And I don't care, like, I mean, it's a personality thing. Yeah, I think everybody's got this. You can't live in this culture and not be driven by those things and not have it twisted. And so when the carrot's dangled out in front of you, go. I want to be a partner. I want to do this. I reach six figures in my income, for example. Like, yes. Oh. There's another carrot out there. There's another carrot out there. And then what's the stick on the other side? Boy, you better keep going or you will be worth nothing. Your value is entirely tied to that thing. Your identity is entirely tied. And that's a lie, but living in the middle of it and growing up with those expectations, it's something I have fit into really easy. And in this culture, I think it really defines who we are, because we can look down our streets and feel the same way. We can go to any of our reunions, high school reunions and feel the same way. What are the things that we talk about? What are we driven to do? I now work for Xenos. I work for the church. And for years, as I first started, I struggled with, well, I work for Xenos. Hey, buddy, you used to.
But
I work for Anderson Consulting.
I used to be somebody.
And I was a director of systems at Nationwide. I was somebody. And, I took a 2/3 pay cut to come work for the church. But I used to. And I still fall into that mode of thinking that way and of thinking. And it just doesn't go away. And it's reinforced by everything around us.
So are you able to provide 3 squares a day for your family? Is there a roof over your head? Are you dying?
No, you know what's amazing is you learn, and there's others who can speak better to this because no Fitzpatrick situation, about the decisions you can make and go, wow, what am I able to actually live on and still give away? And still, I mean, it is such a skewed view we have about, I won't speak for anyone else, skewed view I have of what it was that would make me happy, but what was I need, you know, 80, 90 grand, not even six figures, whatever, 80 grand to make things work, to be able to live in America. And it's just not true. I mean, the meals are on the table, the kids are in school, we've got a couple of cars, got a beautiful house, and God provides.
It is possible to exercise downward mobility, is what you're saying.
And
Malia, I don't want to, that's good, but just to move along. You know, because so here you are, Malia, you're living in New York City, you're living large, you're making a lot of money. The question I have is, you know, how did the, if you can advance, you should advance mentality that's so much a part of talented people's work life, that you would be like sinning against yourself if you didn't realize your full potential in the job for situation. You know, how did that relate to you, and how did you come to a point where that you realized, you know, that's just not going to cut it, that's not good enough?
Well, I worked in the fashion industry, and so I worked in the Garment Center in New York, and very much immersed in appearances and what you look like and what you have. And I definitely tried to advance as much as I could and thought that that's the way that I should be working. I worked as hard as I could, as much as I could. And the problem that I kept running into is I'd reach certain plateaus in my mind, like, okay, well, I've got a sweet apartment at a really good location. I've got, you know, tons of stuff materially, and I'd reach them, and then, well, isn't that stuff supposed to make me happy? Isn't that what, you know, this culture has told me, that if I look a certain way, I make a certain amount of money, I have certain things, doesn't that mean I'm happy? And at the end of the day, after I had all those things, the things I thought were gonna make me happy, I still wasn't happy. And I was lucky enough to have a real crystallizing event in 9/11, because I was living in New York City during when September 11th happened. And it kind of really put things into perspective for me, like, okay, if I died tomorrow, which, you know, I thought I could, is all this stuff going to make any difference? And what are the things that are going to characterize what I did in my life? And it was a whole lot of nothing. It's a whole lot of nothing. So I feel real fortunate to be able to say that, you know, that was something cool that God used to come out of that. But my answer is I just really found that what I was acquiring were not the things that that really are eternal, that really last. It wasn't relationships, it was stuff, and it still didn't make me happy. So all of the advancing that I did really didn't amount to anything.
Do you feel like when you were working in the garment industry and you're putting in these crazy hours and push, and you paid a physical price for this as well, mm-hmm. Did you ever get that feeling like, you know, I'm just really yanking somebody else's wagon here? I'm being used in that sense.
You know, I didn't, because I thought, I mean, I used to get an incredible buzz every single time I would make a really good deal. I mean, I would, like, go buy 100,000 units of whatever it is at a quarter that I knew I was going to sell for, you know, $5. And just, it was just a real rush. It was an incredible rush. But slowly what happened was God started really working on me to change the things that I really, that really did it for me. And then a little bit at a time, those things really didn't provide that buzz anymore. I started really feeling kind of gross after I would do something like that. And then, then I started to think, well, who am I doing this for? I'm doing it for a board of directors. I'm doing it for people who are gonna be able to make money off of this. And as you said, as a result of it, you know, my health paid a price for it. And I wasn't doing it for, I definitely wasn't doing it for me. So, yeah.
Interesting. Thanks, Malia and Steve. Let's press on a little bit here. And I want to talk to Fitzpatrick's a little bit. May or may not know, Sean is a professional golfer and has a PGA card and all that kind of stuff, has had opportunities to live that life, be the club professional, and, you know, all that kind of stuff that you see in Happy Gilmore and that type of thing. And put that aside with the demands of family. Got into the world of sales, has been successful there, and has also been confronted by the reward to success, which is more work and more travel. And the question I want to ask you, Sean, is, you know, how did you deal with your boss's expectations about travel? And did you feel trapped and without options when you started getting pushback from your boss? Like, you know, you should really be committed a lot more to this and so forth. How did that work out for you?
There's been a time not that long ago where the expectation to increase the time that I travel, you know, which is usually about 16 times a year out of the house to New York. I am in the same industry that Malia left, the fashion industry. Very high-paced and high stress. The company that I work for, you know, it's downward trend, and you know, they're looking at me and saying, "Okay, you're one of the top guys, and now we want you to travel between 60 and 100 hour, 100 days a year annually."
Wow.
When I first went to the company, I said, "I don't want to travel too much." You know, and this was, you know, 7 years ago. I don't want to travel too much. I increased that to a point and said, I can't do it anymore because of the things that I've got going on at home and, you know, the life that we want to live, this is what we want to do. So here, I talked to my boss, and he is asking me to do this, to increase my time spent on the road to get new customers, to bring them in so the company can make more money. I said, well, you know, we had that discussion. A day later, the owner of the company comes to me and says, now, this is what we want you to do. And I answered him in the same way that I answered my boss. I said, no, I'm not the guy that you want in that position to do that. I can't do that. And I didn't give any reasons why, but it's something that we've talked about before, and I mean, I have to draw the line in the sand here. I'm unwilling to do that. I'm unwilling to spend the time necessary, and unfortunately, in doing that, there's all kinds of stress and fear, and you know, I mean, completely petrified. It's like, oh, am I going to lose my job now because I'm saying no? But I think that in the past, you know, you talked about, you know, being the golf professional thing. I think the same thing applied then as it does now, and that, you know, God has been consistent and faithful to us as a family throughout the years. And it's like, do I believe, you know, it gets to the point of, well, do we, my wife and I, believe that what God says is true? And here is an opportunity to act on that. So I said yes, and shortly after that time, where I drew the line in the sand with the owner of the company, this account came, and it just so happens that they're 20 miles away from where we work. And a couple days after that, and there was some time spent over there, contract signed. I mean, it was a big deal. And vice president of sales sends an email and says, well, it looks like your travel problems have been cured with this new account. So, mm-hmm. you know, so it was kind of sweet that, that happened in that way. But here we are being, you know, being able to make a stand, though, I think was was the hardest thing, because, you know, the fear is not up. I mean, it's not over. The anxiousness, you know, they can still come and say, hey, look, dude, you know, we still want you to go out. Mm-hmm. And we'll have to revisit that again. And but it's hard. It's being there's some fear, real fear of not knowing what's going to happen next week, next month.
Right.
But yet I think that God being faithful to us has given us an ability to be secure in that, because he's always come through, maybe not the way that we expect it to, but he's always come through in a way that has been like, wow, God, you're really good. So it's created strain on, you know, in the relationship. We've got kids, and you know, there's a lot of things to consider and think about, but I think the bottom line is it gives, God has shown in our face that, okay, here is an opportunity to you to be faithful and trust me. And the question is, are you willing to believe in that? And we say with our mouth we do, and this has given us an opportunity to say, I want to act on that truth that I know is coming from you and not me. So
sweet.
It's pretty cool.
Thanks, Sean. That's really helpful. Now, I want to get Cindy's point of view on this, because your problems could be easily resolved. You're a nurse. You can make good money. You can just go back to work. You've chosen not to do that because you've got young kids, and that's cool. But now, okay, knowing what you know about what you could do, and you look at Sean, and he's basically saying no to his boss, and you're thinking cha-ching, 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 as you're processing through, what does this mean? How have you handled that, Cindy? What's that been for you? How have you dealt with and struggled through the decisions that Sean has made in his professional life to basically say no to career advancement, no to more money, and which is maybe put you at risk?
Well, I have to start out with agreeing with him in that this has been the past 10 years when he made this decision, and I stepped out of work 10 years ago and decided to stay home with these children. And the oldest is now 20, and the youngest is 4. And I'm finding that I have thought, though, you know, okay, I just can't wait till he's 6. I can work more. But I'm looking at the 20-year-old and how available I am for her. Mm-hmm. I was thinking about that today. And even though she's not at home, if I wasn't there, I would miss so much of what was going on with her. Mm-hmm. So it was a good decision 10 years ago when she was 10 when I left. It was hard because I always in the back of my mind know that I can do it. You know, we can double our income in a matter of a couple weeks,
right?
Because it's just so easy to get a job. But, you know, what I would miss out in lieu of that. But how I've managed with the cut in income, I was thinking about that today, too. And I used to drive my daughter to school at Calumet and in my new car all the time up until she was 10. And I'd look at all the beat-up cars in the parking lot and these moms dropping their kids off.
Yeah, thanks a lot.
I would drive out going, I will never do that. I will never be in a car like that. I am always going to work because I don't want to do that. I don't want to put my child at risk to be in a car that might break down. And sure enough, you know, God really called me on the carpet on that. And I just had a 1995 Ford Windstar die like 2 months ago. I look at that and I laugh because it had dents in it and all kinds of problems, but I chugged along in that thing all this time, and it's amazing how God changes your values, because I really didn't care. I was really happy. I wasn't like all that happy. I was content in the fact that I was able to spend that time with my kids and drop them off and pick them up, and if they got sick at school, I could go get them.
Right.
So, you know, when you compare the money to that. It's always hard, you know, our biggest, you know, time out sometimes is going to the zoo, and it doesn't get a whole lot bigger than that, but it's still great, you know. So, and I know that there'll come a time, you know, maybe when they're all out, that, you know, we might have a little more cash in our pockets, but.
You think you're teaching Sharon? Sharon's your 20-year-old.
Yes.
Does she observe this whole dynamic and give commentary about that?
I was thinking about that before you asked that. She doesn't give much commentary about it because she's very verbal about what she needs. So I don't know. But I do know that we have set an example for all three of them. And I do think that the expectation and what she does ask for is a lot less than I think what a lot of kids do expect out there.
It's good for her. That's a great point. Thanks. Sweet. Let's end with Shelley and Gary Ware. Gary, I've known, I don't know, when did you start coming around? 6, 7, 8 years ago. I forget, something like that.
8 years ago.
8 years ago. You're in your third job, I think, now, since I've met you. Fourth, okay. Correct me. But the reason why, Gary's got this, you know, there's a personality similarity across the stage here. You know, is into sales management, is a, you know, your proverbial type A, go at it and do it sort of dude, who is just super talented and able to get it done, and therefore is, you know, bosses like guys like that. But one of the things that Gary came to terms with several years ago, and I remember this real distinctly, is that idea that you need to have boundaries that you bring to your job, and that, you know, you're not just there at the service of your employer, but this is a vehicle to do something real with your life. And to say, you know, could you explain what those boundaries are, how you establish them, and how they have informed the career decisions that you've made?
I think the thing that brought me to this was when I started coming around to Xenos back in 99, and I was in a job where I was traveling all the time. I was leaving Monday, coming back Thursday, every week. And, you know, we were newly married and didn't have kids, so that was okay, acceptable at the time. What I started to realize, though, very quickly was that I was useless to serve in this group. I couldn't develop relationships with people. I couldn't think beyond my own needs at any given point. And I wanted to grow. I wanted to learn more. I wanted to take classes. I wanted to develop relationships. I wanted to get involved in cell group. And I just couldn't do it. And I also saw the impact it had on our marriage. And as a newly married couple, we were, you know, kind of weekend friends is what it came down to. I was gone all the time. And when I was home, I was working. But the carrot and stick thing was very much in front of me with that job. And so I came to terms with the fact that I need to get off the road and learned a valuable lesson. So I actually left. I took about a 45-50% pay cut to step back out of that job. And it's the best thing I ever did. And subsequently, I've had a lot of opportunities to advance in sales management to more of a regional or divisional or area manager position. I've actually been offered promotions I've had to turn down, and subsequently had other people who worked for me or alongside of me become my boss and move up. And that's been difficult to, from an identity standpoint and from just a pride thing, knowing I could do the job, but I'm choosing not to. But I think that the boundaries are I will not travel any longer. More than maybe a day a month if I had to, and I won't relocate. So that really limits my opportunities. And so I've had numerous times where I've had to leave jobs where I haven't really wanted to, because I've either shut a door or, you know, through God's grace, maybe another door opened up for a better situation. And what's amazing, I guess, is that just God always is always faithful and always comes through. And, you know, I've never been without work or, you know, we've always adjusted any income fluctuations up or down. I mean, it's kind of you spend what you have, and God's taught us a lot of lessons. But I still struggle with that quite a bit as far as, it seems like every 2 years I get in a position where maybe a promotion is offered or an opportunity. I have to really wrestle through it and really, you know, thankfully God's put other people in my life to really speak to the truth of that and what, you know, remind me of what's really important. But it's allowed us to be able to develop relationships and friendships in our home group and outside, and to do, you know, to do some ministry as home group leaders. And it's been really rewarding, and more so than taking a promotion or making a few extra dollars. So, and I know, you know, Shelley's been a great influence in that regard to helping me kind of wrestle with the insecurity around that, about, you know, gosh, I should do this because I can, and I feel like I'm letting people down, or I feel like, you know, I'm putting myself at risk to maybe be fired or to be blackballed or whatever.
Kind of so, like is that, do you experience, you sense that in the workplace, that because you're not prepared to compromise your boundaries and continue advancing, are you really at risk, and how do you, you know, manage that in your own head?
I would say that it depends on who your boss is and what the culture of the company is and what other talent they have around you. But I very recently I had a situation with my company where they were counting on me to take this position. I got through the process. What was told about the travel wasn't true. I found out the truth. I pulled myself out at the time of offer, and I pissed a lot of people off. And quite frankly, there were some people that took a stand, said that was really cool that you did that. You know, a couple people kind of came aside, and hopefully that was a maybe an opportunity to speak to them. But there were some people that were pretty frustrated, and I ended up leaving the company and finding another opportunity. But God provided another, you know, that door shut and another one opened. And I'm very happy with what I'm doing now. And I think that in the short term, I'm safe for a while. So.
Sweet. All right. Yeah. Shelley, help us out here. You got a guy who's not afraid to go through four jobs in 8 years to protect principles that he deeply believes in. But you're like, you know, at risk, really, because you've got a household, you've got children, you've got, you know, you're the one who's going to really experience the brunt of that. How did you work that through in your mind and in your relationship?
I think what's really cool is that the anxieties and the insecurities and the things that Gary struggles with, just in life in general and with his career and job, are maybe areas that I don't really struggle with and don't get stressed out about. And I think it's really cool because when these sort of things come into play, like when he used to travel and we were having just a lot of issues, we were starting to realize we don't have any friends, we don't do anything except work and are selfish with our time together on the weekends because that's the only time we have. And that was really what we both realized was our life. And I think when that came into play, I think that God really showed me that you need to speak up to this, and that if it's left just to your husband, he will continue to make decisions like this. He's slowly changing, but you have a voice here. And this is important. This is a decision that you guys make together. And so I think it started there, but over the last 10 years that we've been married, and over the last four or five jobs, each time, and I know that sounds terrible, but to me that is no big deal because the reasons that we change these jobs and make these decisions are totally in line with what we feel like God wants in our life. And so I feel like I'm surrounded by other women and moms that I hang out with all day long who a lot of them talk and they say things like, my husband has to work, and you know, if he's gone, and it's really kind of nice, we're used to him not being around, and you know, but yet they complain that they're stressed out too, being a single mom, sort of. And I feel like what's really happening is most of the people I'm surrounded by are making decisions about their family and their marriage based on their job.
Right.
Whereas I feel like God was showing us to make jobs about your job based on the needs of your family and your marriage. And the people who, relationships that you have, friendships and serving in your church and just being a part of, you know, doing more for this world than just consuming. And so it's a different, you'll make decisions differently with that attitude. And I feel like God just keeps putting that on us and putting that on us. And there's been temptation to say, no, maybe we should take this because, you know, if we just hang in or you know, or we should stay in this job because if you stay two more months, we'll get all this money and a trip. And, you know, there's things like that happen a lot in sales. And God just keeps saying, trust me, and then we trust him, and he totally takes care of us. And he doesn't just meet our needs, he meets our wants too, a lot of times, and just shows us that he's gonna provide for us. So
sweet.
I support Gary.
Yeah, and you've also been a big part of the catalyst to his attitude about work. So you've not been afraid to put a little pressure to say, this is not the way it ought to be in our household. And
right.
God's got a better way.
Yeah, I grew up in a household where money and career were not the focus. And Gary grew up in an opposite type household. So it's really been a strain there, but we've kind of come together and found some middle ground.
Yeah, thanks. Okay, so here's the deal. Here's three couples, and there are many others here tonight, I know, that fit into this category of people who have thought it through. Not impulsive people, not rash, thought it through, made decisions about the draw of financial, you know, the stuff that the world wants us to get our identity from, the kind of the myth of financial security and prosperity and this type of thing. They have balanced that against what it really looks like to be a healthy family, to have real outwardly centered families. Each one of these couples have been home group leaders and continue to serve in a real significant way in their communities, and they're able to do that. And I'm just telling you, the value in listening to them is that this is a doable task. We can be generous, we can have our needs and our wants often, you know, met in some kind of moderation, and we can live a life of real obedience to God. That is possible to do. And when we do that, then we are really giving a super advantage to our children because they know what's important. We are able to take the talent and ability that we have that enables us to excel in the business world and apply that to a life of real ministry, and we're accomplishing things, and there's a satisfaction there that is really hard to put a price tag on. I'm so thankful for these guys. Let's just express our gratitude for their comments. No, go ahead and have your seat. Yeah, let's draw some conclusions here. We'll get into some discussion in our time left. Paul says in verse 5, he says, the thing that really impressed him about these Macedonians was that their first action was to give themselves to the Lord, he says. That they saw their wealth as essentially a spiritual thing. And that they saw themselves as God's children. And so there's something very important there, because I think it's true that if you don't know who you are as a child of God, you cannot afford to be generous. Now, what do I mean by that? What I mean is that if you don't understand who you are before God, and that your significance, your value is a settled deal, that you really do matter to him, that you are beloved by him, then we will look to our careers and we will look to financial acquisition as a way to buttress our sense of identity. And that I am acceptable, I really am okay. And why do I know that? Well, because my boss tells me so. Because I've gotten this raise, because I've gotten that promotion, because I'm able to buy this product. And you know, folks, like these guys were saying, it's just never enough. But there is a feature that I want us to be aware of. Namely, that we are, as people, very easily manipulated. You want your ego stroked, don't you? You want people to say, oh, you just really are, you're the bomb, you know. You rock, you deserve, you know, and all this kind of stuff. And that's the carrot that these guys are talking about. And you absolutely can be completely manipulated into a life of abject compromise, where all you're really about tangibly at the end of the day, regardless of what you say, is yourself
and your stuff and your career. And I say to the person who cannot resist the strong riptide of careerism in our culture, you are being manipulated. Wake up. You know, the thing that was characteristic of all three of these couples is that they had their eyes open. They were thinking in terms of principles and what do I really want to accomplish in life and what is it really all about? And therefore, how does my career fit into this? You know, that made the kind of decisions that they ended up making. It's when we don't think about these things and are unwilling to take a stand that our weakness is manipulated by a system that is far more savvy, far more creative, far more powerful than we are. And we find ourselves drifting further and further and further away. It doesn't happen overnight. It's a process. You know, like the Macedonians that Paul mentions here, if your life is in the hands of a good God and a powerful God, you can trust that He will provide for your needs. That's why Gary can go through four jobs in 8 years. He knows there is a God who loves him more than he loves himself, who cares for his family more passionately than he does. And that by making the decision to put him first, those needs are going to be met. And we can be confident about those things, and we can take a step of faith, and God will respond to that. And lastly, these guys, they were talking about this giving, you know, and the Macedonians apparently were quite poor. Macedonia is a province in northern Greece. It's an agricultural center. Not a lot of wealth there. Certainly not the wealth that the Corinthians would have had, which is Corinth is a port city. There's a lot of money coming in there. People were quite affluent. These people were basically serfs. They didn't have much at all. But they were filled, he says, with abundant joy. And they viewed taking the money that they did have and to give to the famine relief in Jerusalem as a privilege. Oh my God, a privilege to give what little you have to meet the needs of another person. Look, generosity is not some unwelcome, guilt-motivated duty, but the natural extension of entrusting your life to God. When you really are able to stand that ground and say, I believe that God will meet my needs. I believe that God loves the people that He's called on me to serve in this way, that He will provide. If we believe that and are able to take that stand, then as we are then able to give what we've got, there's a real sense of joy that we have in being interested in being about the things that God is interested in and God is about. And so it becomes sort of a blast to give. It's a privilege to enter into this moment where we are bringing attention to the God we worship through the ability to come alongside with real compassion and meet the needs, the pressing needs of people around us. And that's what these guys were doing. They were taking money. They were giving it to the church in Jerusalem. They were buying food, not just for the people in that church, but also for the non-Christian people around them. And Paul says in 2 Corinthians 9, a passage we'll look at in a couple of weeks, he said, they're taking notice. They're seeing that. They're glorifying God because of your generosity. May that be said of us. You know, so there's a way of looking at our wealth that is very victorious, very positive. And this two-chapter section is just full of, you know, invitation by God to say, come in and check out what I am going to do in your life and through you to the world if you would just trust me in this area. And it's so sweet and it's so cool. So that's the spirit with which we want to look at this over the next couple of weeks. What is the great opportunity that God has for us? But I felt like it was really important tonight just to step back and say, you know, look, we are all subject to the same kinds of tensions. the same kind of pull in our career and in our culture to identify our value with the things that we possess, and we the same kind of tendencies towards overwork and indebtedness that are a part of the culture are also things that we struggle with as well. And I just want you to know there are absolutely ways out of that. And we can have success in this area. And we can stand as a beacon of light to a world that is just so obsessed with these things and yet so miserable. So it's cool stuff to think about here. Let's pray together. Lord, we just want to say that, you know, we want to put first things first. We realize that there are forces in our culture that operate against our thinking and against our values, even against our spirit, that are not your thing, and that really are corrosive to our spiritual health and destructive of our ministries. We just pray, God, for some sanity here. Thanks for the clarity of the examples that have been brought out here tonight. I pray, God, that each of us, as we struggle in various areas of this, in our own lives, could have open dialogue in our marriages and our close friendships, and that we could be the kind of group that really, you know, understands and has that freedom over the demands of extracting our identities and significance from our careers and feeling like we've got to have all this stuff. God, just give us some perspective. Give us freedom from the vertigo in this matter that is so characteristic of our culture. Amen.
This study was recorded at Xenos Christian Fellowship and is copyrighted, but you may freely copy and distribute it as long as you keep it intact and do not sell it.